Welcome once again to our program, the 21st series in the Da Vinci Code Deciphered, trying to explain how much against history and against reality and against fact, and particularly as a very frontal attack on the Catholic Church and the basic beliefs of Christianity, the Da Vinci Code, which was a novel that was so popular, and some people estimate between 30 or 40, 50 million copies were sold. It's hard to get an accurate estimate. But we're still closing up on some of the important phases where we feel that the Da Vinci Code is really anti-history. It's rewriting history, and it's not based on fact that it claims to be, even though it's a novel. But there's this big factual sheet in the beginning of the novel saying how much research has been done. My guest again is Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High, church history, world history, American government, and religion. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus at St. Patrick Catholic Church here at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the street here in Terre Haute. Ron, welcome once again to the program, and maybe you could give us a little, because people may be turning in and for the first time or missed an awful lot of the series. So could you just give us a little summary of what makes us so concerned about the Da Vinci Code conclusions that are supposedly based on facts?
What we've been doing in most of the series has been looking at some questions that Carl Olson and Sandra Meisel had asked in a book that they wrote called The Da Vinci Hoax. And they found at least five major things wrong with the book, at least from a Catholic perspective. The first one was that Jesus Christ was not truly divine. You find that throughout, you know, the whole book. But he was merely a good man raised to a deity by the Emperor Constantine in the year 325 at the Council of Nicaea. And we, I think, fairly soundly refuted that just by looking at the facts of history. A second thing that they identify as being wrong with the book from a Catholic perspective is that Jesus Christ came not to save the world from sin, but to restore the sacred feminine, which we spent seven or eight sessions of our series. And then the third point was that Jesus Christ was married to Mary Magdalene and had children. And this is the one we just had begun discussing at the end of our last session. So we'll be starting with that one today and spend today and perhaps one other half-hour session on that. And then two others we'll discuss is that Jesus Christ appointed Mary Magdalene to head the Catholic Church. That's another charge or claim that Dan Brown makes of the Da Vinci Code instead of Peter. And we will refute that. And then finally, his charge that the Catholic Church has kept these and other so-called facts hidden through force and intimidation over the centuries, and we will refute that with the facts.
And it reminds us why good Catholics have so much concern about the fundamental focus that the Da Vinci Code keeps hammering away at. And it's so destructive of a fundamental Catholic belief and even much Christian belief. Well, Ron, let's start on this session with the Da Vinci Code says that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene and that this is a matter of historical record. Now, how do we answer this accusation?
Neither the New Testament nor hundreds of writings of the Church Fathers and other early Christians say anything about Jesus being married to Mary Magdalene. There's not a single shred of historical evidence for this. Not even the Gnostic Gospels, the Gnostic writings that we spent three or four sessions on, and Gnosticism contain such accusations. Shea and Shree whom we have quoted many times.
Authority is on the,
yes,
the Da Vinci Code.
Biblical scholars, and they wrote this book called The Da Vinci Deception, I believe is the name of the book. They claim that, in fact, all the evidence points in the very opposite direction, that Jesus was not married to anyone. Although the Gospels tell us about his father and mother and other relatives, they say nothing about a wife.
And we're talking about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John,
yes,
Gospels, the authentic Gospels.
And moreover, Mary Magdalene is often mentioned with other women, all of whom are identified with their husbands, such as Mary, the wife of Clopas. We find this in John 9:25. Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Luke 8:3. However, she is simply identified with Magdala rather than with a husband. Magdalene was her hometown. That's a town right on the western shore, or at least it was many centuries ago, the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, or the Lake Tiberias, as it was also called. But she's never identified with a man. And Shea and Shree say that this is proof that she was not married at all, let alone to Jesus Christ.
All right, then, Ron, how about Dan Brown's claim that since the Gospel of Philip, the Gnostic Gospel, which we would call a counterfeit gospel, refers to Mary Magdalene as Jesus' companion, he concludes she was married to him?
It doesn't mean that at all. According to Shea and Shree, who are experts in this field, the trouble with this claim is that the Gospel of Philip was not even written in Aramaic, but in Coptic. And the Coptic word for spouse does not specifically mean spouse or wife. It simply means one with whom another has fellowship, which covers, you know, a broad range of relationships, such as, you know, a business partner, a fellow worker, a family member, or whatever. And as a consequence, they say rather than his wife, it most likely that the Coptic word used in this passage is meant to describe Mary Magdalene as Jesus' spiritual sister, or, you know, something like that.
All right. According to the Da Vinci Code, the Gnostic Gospel of Philip, counterfeit gospel, says that Jesus kissed her on the mouth. Doesn't this prove that at least some early Christians believed Jesus and Mary Magdalene had a romantic relationship?
No. In the first place, we have demonstrated, I think, that the Gnostic Gospels were written many years after the events they claim to describe by heretics who were trying to prove a point against orthodoxy. Again, you might recall we spent at least a couple of sessions looking at these various Gnostic writings, and that they were not written in the first century. At the earliest, they were written in the mid-second century, and most of them were written after that, toward the end of the second century, and even some on into the third century. While on the other hand, the regular Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the canonical Gospels, were all written, at least Matthew, Mark, and Luke were probably written before the year 70, and maybe as early as the 60s, and maybe even in the 50s, and well, the Gospel of John was probably written in the 90s, so they were all written by the end of the first century, close to the events that they describe, which makes them all that much more historically reliable documents. And by eyewitnesses, of course. Secondly, the Gospel of Philip does not say that Jesus, quote, used to kiss Mary Magdalene often on her mouth, end of quote. By saying this, Dan Brown is trying to mislead readers regarding this matter, because the actual manuscript that was found is incomplete and fragmented, containing holes where the word mouth is alleged to be. I can attest this because I have seen a facsimile copy of the manuscript, and it contains many gaps, and due to deterioration over the centuries, it was probably made of papyrus, and papyrus, of course, even in a desert climate where it was found, would deteriorate over, you know, many, many hundreds of years. What it does say, according to Shea and Shree, is, because I don't know Coptic, and I wouldn't know, you know, I'd have to take the word of people who know things like this, is a quote, and the companion of Mary, and there's a hole, Mary Magdalene, and then there's another hole in the manuscript, in the actual papyrus manuscript that was found at I think probably one of the ones that was found at Nag Hammadi, loved her more than all the disciples and used to kiss her a hole on, and there's another hole. So there's nowhere does it says that he say that he kissed her on the mouth in the actual
manuscript
itself. And I think as one can readily see, the manuscript doesn't say where and how many times or why Jesus kissed her, if in fact he did, because these Gnostic writings are not to be trusted on matters of fact, as I think we amply proved in some of our earlier sessions. And Shea and Shree state that it could have been simply a kiss of peace, if it actually did take place, or if, even if it didn't take place and they were just simply, the Gnostic writer was trying to make some kind of a point, it could simply have been a kiss of peace or a non-sexual kiss on her hand, on her forehead, on her cheek, or wherever. In other words, the Da Vinci Code is trying to get readers to believe that the kiss is a sign of a romantic relationship between Mary Magdalene and Jesus, when the text itself is, you know, very unclear. They conclude, Shea and Shree conclude, that, quote, nowhere in the Gospel of Philip or in any of the other Gnostic writings is Mary ever presented as the wife of Jesus or even as having a romantic relationship with him, end of quote. They make another important point regarding this matter, I think. They maintain that the Gnostics didn't consider kissing a romantic or sexual gesture in the first place because they believed that the soul was imprisoned in an evil physical body. And, you know, we spent at least one session on that topic. And sex was seen as a means with which to imprison more souls in newly created bodies. So therefore, the main objective of Gnostic spirituality was to free the soul from the body, not to imprison it. So a Gnostic writing would not have had a romantic gesture. A kiss wouldn't have been. They contend that Gnostics considered a kiss a symbol of fellowship between believers and for passing spiritual nourishment from one person to the next. And to illustrate this, they give an example found in another Gnostic gospel called the Second Apocalypse of James, in which Jesus addresses his cousin James as, quote, my beloved, and then kisses him. It's very customary in a lot of countries for men, you know, to kiss each other on the cheek or whatever. They tell us that the gesture is a, quote, non-sexual one intended to show the privileged position of the disciple and his or her special status as the recipient of secret wisdom, end of quote. Remember, that's what Gnosticism means. It means secret knowledge. And this secret, that's why Jesus, they teach that Jesus came into the world, was to give people this secret knowledge so they could escape from their this existence, this material evil existence.
Okay, now what about Dan Brown's claim that celibacy was condemned in ancient Jewish culture? And wouldn't this mean then that Jesus would have married as did all other Jewish men of the time?
The answer to this claim is simple. Celibacy was not condemned in ancient Jewish culture. Being married and having children was the norm for most Jewish men. That's true. But as Shea and Shree point out, in certain circumstances, celibacy was held in very high regard by the Jews of the day. In fact, some of the most reverend men in Jewish history were unmarried. For example, God commanded the prophet Jeremiah to remain unmarried, and Jews considered him as one of their greatest prophets. Moreover, the Essenes, which were a monastic community near the Dead Sea, they considered celibacy an ideal state for its members. And don't forget, John the Baptist was unmarried, and St. Paul, remained unmarried. He was a former Pharisee who not only never married, but he also advocated celibacy as an ideal for Christians. We find this in 1 Corinthians 7, for example. To conclude the discussion on this topic, Shea and Shree state, quote, while celibacy was not common in first century Judaism, it was not unheard of, and it certainly wasn't looked down upon, outlawed, or condemned. As we have seen, it was highly esteemed in some individuals, End of quote. So it wouldn't have been, if Jesus had married, there would not have been, or because Jesus didn't marry, there wasn't anything terribly unusual about it, and certainly was nothing that was condemned in Jewish culture at the time.
Well, I think you gave some good examples, John the Baptist and the Essenes, St. Paul, and I had really forgotten about, who is it, Jeremiah, whom the Jewish people considered one of the greatest prophets, and he was told to remain unmarried. So I think those are good examples, Ron. Well, could we go on and come from a little different angle? Is there any theological reason why Jesus remained unmarried?
Yes, there is. The answer to this is we have to start with the Old Testament or covenant, which portrays the chosen people or Israelites as God's bride. When Israel broke her covenant by worshiping other gods, she's called an unfaithful wife, by, you know, an analogy. An adulteress in Isaiah 50 and 54, for example, and Jeremiah 2 and Ezekiel 16 and Hosea and, you know, and some other places as well, in the Psalms, some of the Psalms. Nonetheless, even though she had been unfaithful to him, God still remained completely faithful to her. That is, you know, the chosen people.
Sure.
God still loved his people and sent various prophets who foretold that one day he would be reunited with his bride, that he would heal her sins, that he would renew his marriage covenant with her. And these prophecies foreshadow the fulfillment of the union between Christ, of course, and his church, which the New Testament compares to a marriage, which the bride, or the church, is the bride of Christ. We see this in Ephesians 5:21-33. We see this in Revelations and in other places. St. John the Baptist refers to Jesus as the bridegroom of his people. In John 3, we find this. And St. Paul develops the theology of Christ, the bridegroom, with his church. We see this in Ephesians 5:25-26. Very famous quotation from St. Paul. And Jesus himself often refers to himself as the bridegroom. For example, in Matthew 2:19, Matthew 9:15, John 3:28-36. Therefore, when Jesus came to establish a new and everlasting covenant, it is appropriate to call him the bridegroom because he fulfilled the messianic prophecies and reunited himself to his bride, the people of God. That is the church, the Catholic Church. From all of this, Shea and Shree, whom we've quoted several times in this series, quote, the fact that Jesus remained unmarried to any single human being more beautifully expresses the profound reality of his complete, unconditional, spousal love for all of his people in the church, which the New Testament calls the Bride of Christ, end of quote.
Okay. May I say then, where do you think Dan Brown comes up with all these really wild ideas that have no foundation in fact?
For those who have been able to follow this series from the beginning, or at least sporadically, they know that none of his claims are original with him. In fact, he even admits that himself. As we discovered during our earlier discussion of Dan Brown's sources, I think it's about the second or third session, the idea that Mary Magdalene is the embodiment of the sacred feminine has been a common one among neo-Gnostic, that is, new Gnostic feminist writers for several decades now.
So how many would you guess? How many decades? 40?
Well, if you go back, in the 19th century, you see, we talked a little bit about that in one of our sessions, you begin to see a lot of this, but especially in the last 20 or 30 years, you've seen a real proliferation of this kind of Gnostic kind of thing, and just in the last few years, you've found almost an explosion. You know, we discussed in our last session, or one of our last sessions, how even over the holidays, the Christmas holidays, there must have been 10 or 12 different programs dealing with the Gnostic Gospels and the Gnostic writings, all with the theme that there were other Christianities, all competing with each other on kind of an equal plane in the early days. But eventually, the Catholic Church, they don't usually use the name Catholic Church, but in most of these programs, but nonetheless, one of the churches was able to muscle the others out, take over, and that's kind of the Dan Brown theme, okay. Of course, that we...
Especially after Constantine,
yes.
And the Council of Nicaea.
Well, their objective has been to, according to these neo-Gnostic writers, their objective has been to rewrite history based on Gnostic writings, such as the Gospel of Thomas that we talked about earlier, and the Gospel of Philip that we just mentioned a while ago, and the Gospel of Mary, and several others. And some of these sources include Elaine Pagel's The Gnostic Gospels, Lynn Pickett and Clive Prince's The Templar Revelation that Dan Brown, you know, includes as his sources. This would include Bagent and Lee's and Lincoln's The Holy Bread, Holy Grail. It would include Margaret Starbird's various books, such as The Goddess in the Gospels, and another one called Mary Magdalene and the Holy Grail, and The Woman with the Alabaster Jar, books like that.
And we could add, Reclaiming the Sacred Feminine.
Yes, and we could add quite a few other books to this list. And furthermore, there are numerous websites that promote Gnostic ideas, including ones that promote these ideas about Mary Magdalene. In fact, I found almost 200,000 hits for her on the MSN search. And as I went down the list for the first 100 or so, I found many promoting Gnostic themes. Moreover, Gnostic themes are readily apparent in novels, movies, television, especially these documentaries that I've been mentioning. I would venture to say in the last year there's probably been 25, 30, maybe more documentaries dealing with these Gnostic Gospels, almost always with the same theme. Okay. They're always trying to find that new, real, historic Jesus. And these are looked upon, a lot of times treated as more historical than the actual Gospels themselves. And then, the list is a long one, but in recent years, movies such as Stigmata, Matrix, and, of course, the Da Vinci Code have come to mind.
Okay, well, I like those quotes you gave, that this is something not really new with Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. This has been circulating for the past 20 or 30 years, and recently almost a flooding programs, supposedly documentary and mm-hmm. historically researched programs. Well, how about Dan Brown's claim that Jesus appointed, we're kind of shifting gears here, Mary Magdalene to be the head of his church instead of Peter, which is, from a Catholic viewpoint, such a wild claim that I just wonder where in the world he came up with that.
Well, some feminist scholars such as Jane Schauberg, Karen King, I've seen her on quite a few of these programs of Harvard Divinity School, call a church headed by Mary Magdalene the Magdalene Christianity. They and others have used the prominent role Mary plays in some of the Gnostic Gospels to suggest that there existed a power struggle between a Marian party and a Petrine party for control of the church. And since Brown says that the winners write history, and the party of Peter's supporters won out, according to him anyway, his version of history, that has come down to us, the version of history that's come down to us, that is Peter's version, has been Peter's version. Carl Olson and Sandra Meisel, they tell us that there's a problem with the feminist interpretation, though. In this regard, they ask, if the winners wanted to diminish her importance, why would they retain her prime role in the resurrection accounts as the first person to receive the good news?
So in the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, she has a pristine place.
Oh, yes.
And called the apostle to the apostles. I mean, history has called her the apostle of the apostles from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Well, also in the Mass, they make another point when they say that Brown has told us that before Constantine elevated Jesus to divine status at the Council of Nicaea in AD 325.
Pardon me? AD 325?
325.
Okay.
Christians everywhere believe that Jesus was simply a mortal man. And they say that if that were the case, who exactly was the Peter party? Presumably, they were the winners, which means that they must have believed in Jesus' divinity, you know, from the very beginning. Because that's the view that won. That's the view that would come down to us. But How can this be, since Jesus' divinity wasn't invented, according to the Da Vinci Code, until A.D. 325? And so, concluding from these inconsistencies, also to my last, so where were they that whole time? End of quote. That's a question they ask. Where were they that whole time? And after examining these and other inconsistencies, they begin to look at the actual evidence itself.
Okay, is there any evidence, Ron, of an Orthodox Christian party that did battle for supremacy with a Magdalene or Mary Magdalene party and demeaned her in the process?
Absolutely not. This is purely a wild guess on Dan Brown's part, and his interpretation is ideologically motivated and based on Gnostic texts, which date from at least 100 years after Jesus' earthly life, and most of them much later than that. It appears to be true that some late 2nd century Gnostic Christian sects did give Mary Magdalene a primary role. However, the passages in the Gnostic writings that insinuate Jesus and Mary had an intimate relationship don't have any elements that can be traced to the 1st century, only to the 2nd or the 3rd centuries. But as Olson and Meisel state, quote, if Orthodox Christian writers of the period knew this, and if it concerned them, they probably would have addressed it directly, for they did indeed speak negatively of some Gnostic sects in which women acted as leaders or prophets. However, the text we have don't specifically critique any group for viewing Mary as a leader of Peter's expense, at Peter's expense, end of quote. Then they go on to say that it is more important that during the period in which Mary was supposed to have been demonized by the Orthodox, that we read nothing but praise for her.
Meaning Orthodox early Christianity.
Yes, yes. True believers, so to speak. But we won't read anything but praise for her, in the early church. For example, they cite Hippolytus, who while writing in Rome in the late 2nd and early 3rd centuries, contrasted Mary with Eve. And then Mary is portrayed as a new Eve who remained faithful to God, whereas the Eve of Genesis betrayed him in the Garden of Eden. He also, Hippolytus, also called Mary the apostle to the apostles that Monsignor just mentioned a while ago there. And they point out that St. Ambrose and St. Augustine, who both wrote a century or so later, also called Mary Magdalene the new Eve. Now, we know, of course, the Blessed Mother is more often not called the New Eve, but here's some church fathers referring to
Mary. I didn't know the church fathers called Mary Magdalene the New Eve.
No, I hadn't either until I come across these quotes. They state the facts are that during the period that Mary's party is supposedly battling Peter's party for the soul of the church, church fathers are writing high praise of her and treasuring gospels that feature her role in the resurrection appearances. That is what we read in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That is the canonical gospels, the Orthodox gospels. So there's nothing in the reality of Mary Magdalene in Scripture or in the way that she has been treated in Eastern and Western Christian tradition that supports anything that Brown contends. And as we keep finding the truth is much more interesting and authentically inspiring than anything the fantasies in the Da Vinci Code might suggest.
Okay, well, we're coming towards the end of the program. Ron, I think you've covered some really important detail information, particularly about Mary and Jesus. So thanks for your wonderful research there. And to our listeners, we say may God bless you always and in all ways.
Good Lord.